Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from thousands of successful individuals from around the world. I'm your host, Ashutosh Garg, and today I'm delighted to welcome a very senior and respected professional, a fellow member of the YPO from St. Louis, USA, Mr. Robert Newmark. Bob, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Ash. It's great to be here.
Thank you. Bob is a food and beverage M&A attorney. He's a partner with Brian Cave, Leeton & Paisner. He has held leadership roles in important civic and charitable projects and organizations, including NCCJ of Metropolitan St. Louis. He's also been associated with the St. Louis Public Schools Foundation and others. And as I just mentioned, he's a fellow member of the YPO. So, Bob, before we talk about anything to do with BCLP, give me a brief overview of your career and how you ended up in specializing in business and transactional counseling.
That's great. Thank you, Ash. So when I first graduated from university, I really wanted to dive into the business world. And I took a role with a management consulting firm. In those days, it was called Strategic Planning Associates. Mm-hmm. It was a spinoff of BCG. Mm-hmm. And we had offices all over the globe and did this really high-level strategy consulting work for really big companies. Mm-hmm. And I loved it. It was a great learning environment. I often say I got my MBA on the road because I was just, immersed in business ideas and challenges and problem solving for the 3 years that I was doing that. But I will tell you what happened to me was that I got into a mode where I could see the people who were senior to me in the consulting firm. Mm-hmm. Their travel schedules weren't any better than mine. I was literally traveling 4 days a week, like every week. And they were also on the road 4 days a week, but like I would go to one place for four days. They would go from city to city to city during the course of the week. Yeah. And I didn't have a family then, but I wanted to. And I knew that if I was going to, get married and raise children, that kind of intense, travel schedule wasn't going to work well for me. So I decided to go to law school. And what law school and ultimately being a lawyer I thought would provide for me was an opportunity to still be engaged in critical business decisions and advice, but maybe not quite as heavy a travel obligation.
Yeah.
And frankly, it's worked out that way. I got out of law school. I jumped into the transactional counseling space and really never looked back.
Fascinating. And so let's now talk about Brian Cave, Leeton & Paisner. What, in your view, are some of the most common pitfalls businesses encounter during a merger and acquisition, and how can these be avoided?
Yeah, so I think that the major pitfalls fall into two categories. One is a failure of planning. Mm-hmm. And the reality is when you go into an M&A transaction, there are a number of things, sort of critical things, you need to think through before you get into trying to negotiate terms with someone and getting a deal done. Mm-hmm. One is what's your theory of the deal? Why do you even want to be engaging in the transaction? So that you know exactly what matters to you and what doesn't matter to you in the course of the negotiation. Mm-hmm. And the second is, how are you going to do the integration on the other side? So if you're a buyer, how are you going to manage that post-transaction process? Mm-hmm. And frankly, if you're a seller, do you want to disengage completely? Do you want to stay involved on some level? And if so, how do you want that to look on the other side of the transaction?
Right.
And when people don't adequately plan, they run into all kinds of issues in the course of the deal. Mm-hmm. There's a second set of issues that I think is a major pitfall that people run into, and that's not having an adequate team around you to get the transaction done. And the team can consist of people inside your company It can also consist of your outside advisors, like your lawyers, your accountants, investment banker, any other business advisors that you work with. And I will tell you on the lawyer front, because I'm a lawyer, so I can talk about this. Far too often, I see sellers of businesses cling to their longtime counsel, their longtime lawyer, to help them with the M&A transaction. And as a result, they wind up being not as well represented in the deal as they could be if they picked somebody who actually knows and does M&A transactions day in and day out. And, you know, trying to get by with someone who is aware of it, but doesn't do it all the time, can lead to major, major, major missed issues in a deal.
Right. Very interesting. And over the years, how have M&A transactions, or how has the M&A landscape changed with the advent of new technologies and maybe new regulations?
That's a very interesting question too, Ash. Over the course of my career, and I've been doing this for almost 30 years now, the major effect of technology on M&A transactions has been the pace. In the old days, when I first got started, we exchanged drafts of documents by fax and FedEx. Email was just kind of beginning, you know, to be around. And we weren't using it that way. And so you typically had time. You get a draft and you had a window of time to think through it, to assess the changes that you'd want to make and respond. In today's world, the expectations for sort of instantaneous response, hey, did you get my email? What's your reaction to it? You know, it's much more intense, and we have to gear our teams so that we're able to respond more quickly and efficiently. But the second thing technology has done is it has allowed us much more efficient and effective methods for identifying changes in documentation. So somebody sends me a marked up, a changed, version of an agreement. I can rely on software to tell me what changes were made and identify the legal words that changed and the like. And I can also use technology to review documents. So the due diligence, figuring out if there are certain clauses in agreements and contracts that the target company has. Instead of having to read all of those manually, we can rely on technology now to do that much more efficiently, in some cases effectively, than we did before. So it's those are the main ways technology has changed the practice.
Amazing. And, you know, on a lighter note, who knows, with ChatGPT, it may do the entire merger and acquisition on its own.
But... So maybe, you know, we do talk about that, like how will artificial intelligence affect what we do? And I do think a lot of jobs in the legal industry will become obsolete because of AI. But I actually think my role in an M&A transaction, which is providing advice and guidance on strategy and strategic choices that come up, and risk assessment, and sort of balancing the allocation of risk, those are things that the human touch, for the foreseeable future anyway, I think can be very valuable. And I don't think in the near term my job is at risk, but it could be down the road. We don't know. We don't know.
I know. But tell me, Bob, you know, you told me a little bit about what are the steps or stages of an M&A transaction within, say, a country. What are the complexities if you start looking at cross-border M&As?
Yes. And I do a lot of work cross-border. In fact, almost all of the transactions I work on today have some cross-border component. And that's you know, a tribute to the fact that so much of our commerce today is cross-border and intertwined. And so even if you have a company based in the United States buying another company based in the US, very often they will have suppliers or manufacturing facilities in another country, or they'll have customers in other countries. And so there will be cross-border compliance issues that we need to contend with in the course of the deal. The big challenges are you have different legal constructs in different jurisdictions. And so as part of your team, you need resources to be able to assess whether you're complying with the law in every jurisdiction where it matters. And the other thing, frankly, is different cultural expectations and attitudes around what's happening in an M&A transaction. I can remember the first time I did a transaction involving people in China on the other side, and a recognition that the way they thought about the deal itself, how they approached, you could say it's how they approached the negotiation, but it was really how they approached communication at all, was just very different than, say, people in the Midwest in the United States. And we had to work through those cultural differences to reach an understanding in addition to the deal terms.
Right.
You know, and that you need people on your team who are adept at that and understand that that's an important part of how this works.
Well said, well said. You also do a lot of work in structuring joint ventures and strategic alliance.
Yes.
How do you assess businesses in doing joint ventures and strategic alliances?
So, you know, when a client comes to me and they're thinking about how they can solve a problem, they want to get into different markets, or they want to reach out into a different line of product offerings, often the conversation will start with, let's do an acquisition, let's buy a company that can help us solve that problem because they're already in the space we want to get into. And I will remind people that that's not the only way to solve that issue. And sometimes it's more cost effective, and it frankly, it can be more productive and profitable to, rather than acquiring in whole one of those companies, forming an alliance with them and trying to go to market together. And the reason for that is that sometimes the best companies out there that you might want to acquire or do that work with, sorry, I have to move or my lights go off. If you don't, they may not be for sale. They may, those businesses may be performing so well that they're not interested in engaging in that M&A transaction. However, they might be willing to engage in some kind of a strategic alliance or joint venture.
Right.
And opens up a completely different avenue. And so in terms of your strategic alternatives, it just, it gives you more to think about and more levers to pull as you move through, you know, addressing those strategic issues.
Fascinating. You know, when I was reading about you, you also support people in succession and estate planning.
Yes, I do.
Tell me a little bit about this part of your expertise as well.
So, you know, Ash, a lot of people get into mergers and acquisitions and they spend, they just do the M&A work. That's it. And I was even talking earlier, it's important to find an M&A practitioner who that's where what their focus is. It's what they're doing day in and day out. And that really is what I do. And it's what I've long been doing. But as I became an advisor to a number of privately owned companies, particularly family owned businesses, I realized that they, one of the key issues they had, and it's one of the reasons we often talk about M&A with those companies, is succession planning. Who in the next generation will take over that business and run it? And as we worked on those succession planning issues, I realized that the succession planning, the estate planning issues that are sort of buried in there, you know, were really well covered by my colleagues in my law firm who do day in and day out estate planning work. And so I became an adjunct member of our estate planning group to learn the craft. I really wanted to understand the ins and outs, the different techniques that people apply, so I could advise those family-owned businesses directly obviously I bring in, you know, the team members when we have to draft a trust or really get into the nitty gritty on the planning, but I needed to understand the broad scope. And then once I learned it, I realized I could apply it in a whole host of other areas.
Yeah.
And I actually have brought in a number of clients directly to the firm, not for their business work, but for their estate planning work, because they realize I do have a certain amount of expertise in that space now. So that's how it developed. And I actually really like it. It's a whole nother, I like solving puzzles, Ash. And that's why I really enjoy being a lawyer.
Fascinating.
And it's a whole different puzzle, often sitting right on top of the M&A work. And one other thing I should note on this, it's an issue that's often missed. Mm-hmm. I think the vast majority of people, when they get ready to sell their business, get focused on the sale transaction. And even if they're doing it well, and they do what I talked about earlier, the advanced planning work and building the right team, they leave out thinking about this aspect of it, which actually requires some work well in advance of going to market to sell your company. And I love it when I'm engaged on a transaction like that and I can add that additional value for my.
Fascinating. And, you know, one of the things that I've also picked up when I was reading about you and when it comes to estate planning is that you say that you use highly sophisticated techniques and concepts. You know, when you are talking of estate planning, tell me a little bit more about this.
Well, you know, this mostly applies to the U.S. System of estate taxation. Mm-hmm. We have cross-border transactions. We have to look at the estate taxation regimes in different countries. And it's fascinating how many different arrangements there are across the globe.
Right.
But in the U.S., you get a certain amount of assets that you can hold when you die, and there's no tax on them. But above a certain threshold, your estate is subject to taxes, and they're pretty high. It's 45%.
Right.
So there is a tremendous value in trying to get assets out of your taxable estate before you die. And the techniques that we do this, you know, have all been held up in by either by the IRS directly or in court cases, so that we, you know, keep things very clean and legal in this regard. But in order to do it, they are fairly complex, basically by taking discounts on the current value of certain assets and then either selling them or gifting them into a trust.
Right.
Enough criteria that the gift is completed and outside of your estate. And then that trust can continue to own those assets and the appreciation on those assets. And all of that grows outside of your estate for the rest of your lifetime. And so there's just a whole host of issues in making sure that you comply with the technical requirements to make that happen.
Fascinating. So time for two more questions for you. My next question is that I'm going to ask you to look into your crystal ball and say that, where do you see the future of business and transactional law heading, especially given the current global trends?
Yeah, so I think we are actually kind of in a little bit of a slowdown in M&A in the United States and globally right now. But I don't see that continuing. I think it will pick up again, particularly as global interest rates start to come down. And the volume of M&A activity, particularly cross-border M&A activity, is likely to continue and perhaps accelerate because the need to provide goods and services globally is just growing and growing. And the demand is there, the market opportunities are there, the interest, you know, the national interest of so many countries across the globe to you know, really have this interconnected economy is so supportive of that I believe it will, the these transactions will, the number of transactions and will continue to grow.
Amazing. And my last question to you, Bob, and this is for the thousands of people who will listen to our conversation. Based on your deep understanding of the legal system, what would you say are three lessons for young lawyers that you think our young viewers and listeners should take back from our conversation?
So for young lawyers, people getting into the practice, particularly in the transactional space, but probably in any area, I tell them regularly, number one, your learning curve is huge. There's such a volume, not just of legal, even if you've had a great education at a law, premier law school, there's so much you don't know about the law and how it applies practically that you have to immerse yourself. And the first few years of the practice are, you really have to dive in and give all of yourself so that you can absorb as much learning as you can. And that's hard because you're giving up other things. But if you invest that time early, it'll help. So that's one key thing I tell people. Second thing is, and this maybe sounds contradictory, but you have to remember that this is a marathon and not a sprint. And so you have to make time for yourself. You have to find outside hobbies and interests. You know, for me, it was a passion in the community, in civic organizations and the like, that I, you know, I used to create space for myself. And for many years, I also taught in the law school. But if your spare time is just exercising, or if it's a book club, or if it's, helping with people who have food insecurity, whatever it is, make time for it, because that's also making time for yourself and the like. And the same is true, frankly, of vacation and holiday time. I think it's critically important that you recharge your batteries.
Absolutely.
And then the third thing I will say, and it sits on top of all of that, is not to take yourself too seriously and actually try and have fun, because what you will do in your job will be the vast majority of what you do during your lifetime.
Correct.
And if you can't find space to have fun with it,
yeah,
laugh at yourself and your mistakes, to build friendships and to enjoy the people that you're working with, you'll be miserable.
Right.
So I encourage people to look for opportunities to have fun, relax, and enjoy the process and what's going on around you, even though high stakes, it's high pressure. There's a lot of intense intellectual work that's going on. Try and have some fun with it.
Well said. And on that note, Bob, and your three wonderful lessons. The first one you said was learning curve is huge. Immerse yourself in the first few years and learn. Second you said was, find time for yourself. And the third one you said was, don't take yourself too seriously. Learn to have fun. Thank you, Bob, for speaking to me about your incredible journey. Thank you for speaking to me about so many different aspects of law, cross-border transactions, and mergers and acquisitions. Thank you again
Ash, I'd like to say I really appreciate what you're doing. I love the conversations that you have with people, and I'm so grateful that you had me join you today.
Thank you so much. Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.